Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia, and I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS FM and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Our subject today is, imbeciles. Our subject today is stupidity. Why would we pick such a silly subject, you may ask? Well, because just recently I saw a very interesting piece, a newspaper article, by a fellow named Sanford Levinson. He's a law professor, a historian type of guy from Texas. And he wrote a very provocatively entitled piece called Our Imbecilic Constitution. When you see a title like that, you've got to say to yourself, I've got to read this article. And what it turns out is that Sandy looked at our current political landscape and the gridlock that seems to prevail and the heavy-duty partisanship that seems to be preventing anything from getting done. He said, let's not just blame the people who inhabit our offices at the moment. Let's not just blame politicians. Let's not just blame the political climate. Let's look at the Constitution itself. And let's ask ourselves whether our Constitution, as it currently exists, is the basic root cause of this political dysfunction. And as you might guess, Sandy thinks that perhaps it is, and he suggests that there are several things about our Constitution that, if not quite imbecilic, are rather silly. I should mention the title, Our Imbecilic Constitution, comes from the Federalist Papers. Alexander Hamilton actually used the phrase when he was referring to what is arguably our first American Constitution, something called the Articles of Confederation. And so just as Alexander Hamilton was criticizing the Constitution of his day as he proposed reforms in a new Constitution, Sandy Levinson is doing the same with ours. I spoke to Sandy recently, and, let's just share the conversation with you.
The first paragraph of the piece quoted from Alexander Hamilton's 15th Federalist Paper,
right,
in which he was explaining the necessity of basically junking in a quite ruthless way the Articles of Confederation, which in a very real sense was our first Constitution.
Yes, Sandy, let's talk about that for just a second. I mean, and let's just orient ourselves. You know, 1776, we declare independence. We don't have a government at that point.
Right.
And it's not till about 1781 when we actually had a document called, as you just said, the Articles of Confederation.
Right. And by 1787, it was widely, though I have to say, not universally agreed that we really couldn't function adequately under the Articles. But in any event, in the 15th Federalist Paper, Hamilton described as imbecilic the government that had been basically foisted on us by the Articles. And
So we got some history here. We got a history not only of declaring our independence from another nation, we've got a history of junking our own Constitution.
That's right. At the national level, and it's even more dramatic at the state level, one of the points of a new book that I recently published called Framed, and the subtitle is important. It's Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance, is to try to bring home to readers that there are at least 51 constitutions in the United States. The United States Constitution is obviously only one of them. And the reason I say at least is that each state has had just short of an average of three constitutions.
Wow.
Louisiana and Georgia lead the pack with 23 constitutions between them.
Really, that many? I didn't know.
Other states, like Massachusetts, get along with its original constitution of 1780, but it's really...
Of course, very few of us have the advantage of having a state constitution drafted by John Adams.
That's certainly part of it.
Okay.
But what we have in this country, and what I think we are now sadly, sadly lacking, is a spirit of scrutiny or inquiry or criticism of existing constitutional schemes and a willingness expressed not only in Hamilton's quite flamboyant language with regard to his critique of the Articles, but my favorite passage in all of the Federalist Papers is the conclusion of the 14th Federalist, which was written by James Madison, in which he emphasizes that the glory of America is a willingness to think for itself and to learn the lessons of experience and not to be tied down by traditions that no longer serve us well, or what he called names. And I think by names, quite ironically, he would refer today to the artificial veneration placed on James Madison, where instead of focusing on what I think is most admirable about Madison and Hamilton and many other of the founders, that is their willingness to think for themselves and do what they thought was necessary in 1787, really to save the country, instead we have turned them into demigods and take their decisions as the final word.
Well, hold on, hold on a second, Sandy. Are you telling me the Constitution is not sacred writ?
It certainly shouldn't be. it has become that in American culture, and I think that's a very interesting and, from my perspective, depressing aspect of American political culture. Another book that I've written called Constitutional Faith that the Princeton Press brought out in a second edition last year with a new afterword focuses on the development in American culture of a tendency to treat the United States Constitution as not really a human document where the first thing you remember is that to err is human, but really as the product of divinities who met in Philadelphia and who therefore gave us something that we can only accept and not think about critically. And so the real spirit of my piece in the Times, so to say, I really don't back off from the title they gave it, is that there are many lessons of experience that we should learn about the current Constitution, that if one wants to understand why at this moment less than 1 in 7 Americans is willing to express any real esteem for Congress, and it goes up a bit, but not wildly high with regard to the presidency, and even the United States Supreme Court, I think for the first time in the history of polling, is now under 50%, somewhere between 40% and 44% of the American public approves of the Supreme Court. This is an astonishing withdrawal of what, for lack of a better term, might be called affection for our basic political institutions that are the product of 1787.
Yeah, I don't want to go off on too much of a tangent here, Sandy, but something has occurred to me along these same lines, and it's some of the very people who express the greatest reverence for the Constitution and who have elevated it, you know, almost to the point of holy writ, really do treat it like they would some other holy book. I suspect in the first instance that most of them have probably not read it. And in the second instance, some of these very same people who love the Constitution absolutely hate the government that it created.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and I think that that is a very, very significant paradox that we ought to be discussing much more than we are. 100 years ago, in the presidential election of 1912, two of the three candidates, and the two actually got the most votes, Woodrow Wilson and Teddy Roosevelt, and then, of course, William Howard Taft later became the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, so he was definitely no slouch in any sense. But Wilson and Roosevelt were constitutional reformers, and they were laying before the American public 100 years ago basic criticisms of aspects of the Constitution, not that they wanted to tear it up. It's not that they wanted to treat it the way the framers treated the Articles of Confederation. But what they said is that the Constitution is decidedly imperfect, and as we enter the new 20th century, we really do need to think of how it might be changed to make it work better in the 20th century. And what you find in the decade 100 years ago was genuine constitutional reform. We get, you know, some people are very unhappy about this in retrospect, but we get the 16th Amendment, which really did transform the United States in some significant ways by allowing the income tax.
Mm-hmm.
We get the 17th Amendment, which established direct election of senators instead of having senators appointed by state legislatures. We get the 18th Amendment, which has a checkered history, that is the Prohibition Amendment.
Yeah.
But I think it's important to recognize that it was supported by a wide body of Americans roughly 100 years ago, including people who call themselves progressives, because they viewed, and I think they viewed correctly, alcoholism as a real scourge, and believed, as it turned out, I think falsely, that a prohibition amendment would really provide a way of curing that problem rather than leading, in a certain sense, to the cure being worse than the disease.
Right.
But I don't think we should simply scoff at the spirit behind the 18th Amendment, because it did represent an attitude that, you know, we could respond to what are viewed as really significant problems. And then the 19th Amendment, of course, guaranteed the rights of women to vote.
Yeah, so that's a little easier to defend right now.
Yes, yes. So, you know, it was a very, very generative decade. And part of the reason is because you had public leaders at the very, very highest level, but you also had the equivalent in that era of pundits, of public intellectuals, of writers, of, you know, reformers, radicals, talking about the need for constitutional change. There was also, incidentally, a very, very rich period for state constitutional change. There have been in our history roughly 225 to 230 state constitutional conventions. This is why each state has had close to an average of three constitutions. So it really was just a very, from my perspective, inspiring period where people were willing to say, okay, how are we being served by our basic institutions, and how might we need to tweak them or indeed significantly to change them? And that's what I think is so desperately lacking right now, that we have two Harvard-educated lawyers running for the presidency, and neither of them is interested in saying anything about the Constitution other than to assure us that both of them love it.
Well, that's kind of funny because, you know, a president has to take an oath that he's going to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. And that was actually something I was going to ask you about is, you know, the president has to take the oath in order, of
right.
course, to be inaugurated. But the similar oaths are taken, judges have to take that oath pursuant to the Supremacy Clause.
Every single employee of any state, national, state, or local, has to take an oath. But part of the Constitution is Article 5, which talks about amendment. So another book that I edited a number of years ago was called Responding to Imperfection.
Mm-hmm.
And that title came from a letter by George Washington to his nephew, Bushrod, who actually ends up being on the Supreme Court himself in the 19th century. And what George Washington says is, look, there's no reason to think that the Constitution is perfect, and that's why it includes an amending clause as a way of responding to imperfections that later generations will undoubtedly see. So I don't think it involves any violation of the oath to say I have a duty to support, protect, and defend the Constitution, to obey the law, but part of defending the constitutional order is to say that there are ways that the institutions we have aren't allowing us adequately to achieve the goals set out in the preamble. And I love the preamble. I think that the preamble really is an inspiring set of goals that every American should strive to achieve. And so I don't see that it raises any problems with the oath, unless a president were to say, well, because I think the Constitution is deficient, I'm simply going to ignore it and pretend that I have the Constitution I really wish I had rather than the Constitution we have. So, you know,
You make a really good point here, Sandy, because and I'm glad I hadn't really thought that part of it through. You know, the fact that you take an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, which lots of government officials do and everybody who joins the military does, doesn't mean that you are promising to preserve it in its precise form forever and ever, because the Constitution itself provides for changes.
Right.
In fact, that's actually, it's sort of a non-constitutional perspective to say, I want to cast this in stone or carve it in marble and worship it. No, the Constitution itself actually has an amendment process, and it's contemplated from the very beginning. So if you really want to preserve the Constitution, you want to preserve the ability to amend it.
I mean, obviously, I couldn't agree with you more. And I mean, I really do wish that when teachers teach the Constitution, whether it is in grade school or high school, undergraduate teaching or, you know, law school teaching, where I spend most of my time, but recently I have been doing some undergraduate teaching, and actually I'm now writing a book with my wife that will be directed more at middle grade kids. But I really do think it is essential for teachers to say, look, here is the Constitution. It was drafted by some genuinely great men, but they didn't think they had gotten it just right. They did the best they could for the circumstances of 1787. And the best evidence of this is not simply, you know, a speech or a Federalist paper, but Article 5 itself. So I do know that some teachers have included as part of their curriculum in teaching the Constitution mock constitutional conventions where kids are invited to think about what sorts of amendments might they like to see.
You know, Sandy, I am so happy. I'm so happy to hear you say that, because Article 5 is part of the Constitution, and what those teachers and what you seem to be addressing is what I like to refer to as the Mount Rushmore syndrome.
Exactly.
You know, we look at these founders as if they are carved of marble, if they're carved of rock, if they were, as you say, demigods, and nothing they did bears any changing. Well, they themselves, not only in Article 5, but in lots and lots of contemporaneous statements, talked about the Constitution as being an imperfect document, the subject of compromise. In fact, when James Madison was favoring ratification in the Virginia Ratification Convention, he had to defend himself against accusations that he thought it was perfect.
Right,
and he
right.
said right then and there, no, I don't think it's perfect. I didn't get my way on everything. I had to compromise, and no doubt we're going to have to change things in the future. But it's the best we could do. So let's, you know, he certainly was in favor of ratifying it, and he got his way on that issue. But I don't think that he would have been the last person to say, you know, I'm a god, and therefore don't change a thing I've done.
Right. I mean, the most important compromise involves slavery. And nobody today, I assume, would say, well, because the framers in 1787 thought it was necessary in order to get the Constitution in the first place, which was probably right as an empirical matter, that it was necessary to make a pact with slave owners and to protect them by giving them extra representation in the House of Representatives, and therefore extra representation in the Electoral College, and therefore, incidentally, the ability to stack the Supreme Court with pro-slavery judges, which was by and large the reality until the presidency of Lincoln, I don't think anybody would say, well, because they thought it was necessary to make that compromise in 1787, we ought to cherish slavery in the 21st century. That would be just crazy.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm having a fascinating discussion with Sanford V. Levinson, a professor of law at the University of Texas Law School. In just a minute after the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and we'll talk some more with Sandy, because, you know, he's got some really interesting proposals for fixing our Constitution, a Constitution which, well, at times just seems downright imbecilic.
Hello.
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 For the Constitutional Quiz, and here from James Madison's Montpelier is our quiz lady, Kelly Carmichael.
Hello, Stuart.
Hello.
I'm so excited. I have a question on James Madison.
On James Madison himself. Well, sports fans, get out your pen and paper, and let's get ready to take our Constitutional Quiz. Oh, do we have a contestant?
Yes, we do.
Oh, tremendous.
he's in a question on James Madison. He's like, I don't know.
Oh, who are you, contestant?
This is Brian from Chattanooga, Tennessee.
From Chattanooga, Tennessee. What a fine, fine place.
Brian, who's your favorite founding father?
I'm going to have to go with Thomas Jefferson.
Oh!
You could. You
I was
could.
Trying to give you extra credit points to start off.
Right then and there, you could have won the quiz. But you
that.
Blew it.
Thomas Jefferson. John Adams.
Thomas Jefferson. And neither one of them were at the Constitutional Convention. This is a show about the Constitution. You picked the two guys who weren't there. Thanks a lot, pal.
Thanks for playing along.
Next guy. Yeah, next caller. Let's get another contestant. All right, Brian, you can have your favorites, such as they are. But let's go ahead and go to the actual quiz question, shall we?
All right. All right, Brian. So I don't have a question about Thomas Jefferson, but I do have a question about my buddy James Madison.
Okay.
All right, here it is. During the American founding period, James Madison argued that a Bill of Rights was unnecessary in the United States Constitution because, A, Congress did not have the power to violate individual rights such as speech, religion, and the press, since it was confined by the enumerated powers in Article 1, Section 8. B, the existence of the state constitutions had proven that Bill of Rights were no better than parchment barriers when overbearing majorities were intent on violating the rights of some minority. C, given the temper of the country at that time, any Bill of Rights they could adopt would not go far enough in protecting individual rights, especially the rights of conscience. D, all of the above. E, none of the above. James Madison had always been a strong advocate for a Bill of Rights.
What, we've got A through E?
E this time.
That is diabolical. Don't we
no, changing it up. Well, he doesn't like James Madison, so.
So we're making it more hard.
Yeah.
More hard for poor Brian. Okay, so James Madison said that a Bill of Rights was unnecessary.
Unnecessary in the United States Constitution. Okay, well,
Because of what? Let's go through them one by one for Brian. What was A?
Brian, A was Congress did not have the power to violate individual rights such as speech, religion, and the press, since it was confined by the enumerated powers in Article 1, Section 8.
What do you think about that one?
Factually, I think it's correct. I don't know if it's the only correct answer, though.
Oh, okay. So you think A is a good answer because essentially what it boils down to was you don't need a Bill of Rights because Congress only's got the powers we've given it, and we didn't give it the power to oppress us in our speech or religion or whatever.
That's right.
Okay, that's A.
B, the experience of the state constitutions had proven that Bill of Rights were no better than a parchment barrier when overbearing majorities were intent on violating the rights of some minority.
Now that one just sounds good. I don't know why.
He likes
overbearing majorities.
He likes B as well. Okay, so that, in other words, just there's no point in putting it down on paper because if the majority is going to be overbearing, the majority is going to be overbearing. Okay, what about C, Kelly?
C, given the temper of the country at that time, any Bill of Rights they could adopt would not go far enough in protecting individual rights, especially the rights of conscience.
I think there's some truth to that statement, especially because everybody was trying to, you know, get away from an overbearing king at that time, and so, you know, that may be true as well. So tempers may have been flared.
All right.
So he likes C as well.
He likes them all. All right. So then D, the choice answer choice was all of the above. Mm-hmm.
I suspect he'll like that one too, based on what he said. What do you like all of the above then?
I do like that one, but E throws a major curveball.
Oh, here's
a... I'm not a big, I don't know a lot about Mr. Madison, so.
Okay, so while D says all of the above and E says none of the above, so that's what you're hesitating between?
He was none of the above. James Madison had always been a strong advocate of a Bill of Rights.
But I'm just going to go with my gut original feeling. I'm going to go with D.
With D, that all of A through C are reasons that James Madison thought that a Bill of Rights was not necessary.
That's right.
And that's your final answer choice?
That's my final answer.
Ding, 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 ding.
Congratulations to Brian. Brian, you nailed that one.
I appreciate it. That's all that Ole Miss U.S. history coming out in there.
That's what it is. Ole Miss, huh? Okay, we have to give credit to the history department at Ole Miss. Well, that's exactly right. You know that, and that's one of the great mythologies of James Madison, is that he was the guy who was the the big supporter of the Bill of Rights. Now, there's certainly a strong element of truth there because he was very much part of the drafting of the Bill of Rights. He had a huge influence. He was a member of the first Congress, and so when it actually came time to do it, he was the man on the spot. But prior to that, and certainly during the actual Constitutional Convention and during the ratification debates, he kept saying, guys, don't worry about a Bill of Rights. We don't need one for all the reasons that were put out here. So he had to bow to political expediency and go with the majority. And they actually had to promise during the ratification that they would do a Bill of Rights, and they did it.
His first act of Congress.
Yes, so that's a very interesting point in history about James Madison.
Brian, I'm gonna get you to like James Madison at some point.
Yes, you're gonna have to like James Madison at some point. All right, Brian, thanks very much. You earned yourself a T-shirt, and we appreciate you playing along with the quiz.
Thanks, Brian.
No problem. Thanks for having me, guys. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to your weekly Constitution, and we're talking with Professor Sanford Levinson of the University of Texas Law School, who's got some really interesting proposals for changing our Constitution. And one of the obstacles that anybody encounters when he suggests any kind of change is the tendency that some of us have not just to respect the Constitution, not just to want to study the Constitution, but to actually want to worship it. In fact, it happened in the most notable episode of Constitution worship that I've seen recently, and I'm talking, of course, about when the current session of Congress opened with a public reading of the Constitution, and you have these members of Congress getting up there and reading this, again, as if it's holy writ, and they simply cut out all the embarrassing stuff about slavery.
Right.
It's just as if it never existed. Now, the argument was, oh, well, we've repealed that, or we've changed that, or we've amended that.
But that cuts, of course, both ways. We did repeal it. Now, it took a war to bring about the conditions for repeal, but you can't at one and the same time say we have this wonderful, wonderful document that we should treat as holy writ, but you should also know that there were some decidedly unwonderful parts of it that we've repealed. Because then that should logically lead to the next question of, well, is there anything in the current Constitution that we might think about and modify or repeal? And, nobody's going to argue, I think, that anything in the current Constitution is so completely bad as slavery, but there are still things in the Constitution that really do disservice a very serious way and ought to be discussed. And so what was really behind my op-ed piece is that, you know, I really, really want to generate a public discussion, not necessarily, I certainly don't expect everybody to agree with me, but that's not really the point. The point is the conversation itself, which is so, well, I'm so grateful for you giving me this opportunity today to, you know, have people talk with their friends and neighbors and ultimately perhaps even put pressure to bear on so-called leaders to address the extent to which we're being well-served or not so well-served by aspects of the United States Constitution.
I mean, let's have a little bit of that conversation now, Sandy. Give me your top two or three things that you think are problematic in our current Constitution and how perhaps you would address them if you could.
My answer depends to some extent on what's going on in the wider, polity at the time. But let me simply give you, several examples. One of them is that, United States Senate. I mean, take that as the easy example. James Madison himself was appalled by the principle of equal representation in the Senate. And this was at a time when Virginia had only roughly, I think, 17 times the population of Delaware, which was then the smallest state. Today, California has 70 times the population of Wyoming.
Yeah, if you want political clout, move to Wyoming.
That's exactly right.
Your vote counts for a lot more there, doesn't it?
If you want to understand why we have the really terrible agricultural policies we do, then you have to understand that particularly the upper Midwest states have a clout in the United States Senate that they could never, ever get if the Senate were elected under anything even close to a one-person, one-vote rule that obtains in all of the states. So that would be, I think, Exhibit A for an institution that even at the time was not defended substantively by Madison. In the 62nd Federalist, where he talks about the Senate, he's quite happy to have a second house. That's no problem with him. And he thinks longer terms are fine and that sort of stuff. But when it comes time to talking about equal vote, all he says is, well, this is a lesser evil. And what's the greater evil? No constitution at all. And so he doesn't try to defend it in a substantive way and say this is a desirable aspect of the Constitution. What he says is this is something we have to swallow, and it's worth supporting in order to have a constitution in the first place, but really for no other reason.
Sandy, I just have to laugh here because when I ask you what you think is problematic in our current Constitution, you are going back to one of the big debates that happened in the Constitutional Convention itself.
Yes.
You're basically
that's
saying
exactly right.
we still have the problem. We still need to fix it.
One of the great ironies about Madison, who is often viewed as the father of the Constitution, is that he was extraordinarily disappointed in his own child at the time. He thought that equal voting membership in the Senate was appalling. He also fought very hard and unsuccessfully to empower Congress basically to override any state laws that Congress thought didn't serve the nation well. At least in 1787, he was not a states' rights buff. He really wanted a far, far stronger, more proportionately represented national government than we got. But that's only one example to set it. You asked for several examples. I have very mixed feelings now about our basic choice for a separation of powers so-called checks and balances system, which was based on the notion that there would be no political parties and that Congress and the presidency would be filled by public-spirited men who would think really only of the national interest. Well, that vision didn't survive even a decade, really. By the election of 1800, you had a full-scale party system, and we came close to civil war when the Federalists were reluctant to allow Thomas Jefferson to take over the presidency.
I think it was unraveling even earlier than that. I would go back at least to 1796. But I think... Be that as it may.
No, I view that as a friendly amendment. I was talking to an historian last week who said 1793 might be. But the obvious point is that that vision just didn't survive. And one of my favorite books that was published just recently this year is a book by Tom Mann and Norm Ornstein called It's Even Worse Than It Looks, where what they say is that we have fundamentally a parliamentary kind of party system that is two very, very ideologically divided parties. For the first time, I think, since political scientists had been measuring this sort of thing, there is no overlap at all between the Republicans and Democrats in Congress, which is to say the most moderate or liberal Republican is to the right of the most conservative Democrat in both the House and the Senate.
It's pretty darn close.
And this is, you know, what you normally find in a parliamentary system, and in a parliamentary system it really doesn't matter, because you have a government which either consists of the single party that got a majority in the last election or a coalition of parties who come together to govern, and they get their programs through, and then the next election will be basically about whether you like their programs or not. If you don't, you toss the rascals out. Instead, what we have is a political system really geared significantly to gridlock, making it impossible for the national government effectively to confront our problems. And I think to go back to the polling data about 12% approval rate for Congress, well, that can't simply be measuring partisanship, because if it were merely partisan response, then you would expect, 30 or 40% to like Congress, either Democratic or Republican, and then another 30 or 40 or 50% say, no, I don't like Congress. You would expect the disapproval of the president or the Supreme Court to track simple partisanship. But actually, you don't find that. You find a much more significant withdrawal of support. And I think that's because whether you're on the right, the left, or in the center, you are really, really frustrated by the inability of particularly Congress to respond effectively to whatever you think are the most important problems of the day.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Professor Sanford V. Levinson about his recent op-ed piece entitled Our Imbecilic Constitution. Sandy's very critical of some parts of our Constitution, and in fact, he thinks they're downright silly. Well, Kelly Carmichael, what's happening this week at Montpelier?
Well, time to get your hiking boots ready to go, because we are going to march on past James and Dolly Madison's home and right into James Madison Landmark Forest. for our fall big walk series that we do with our resident horticulturalist, who I know you know well, Sandy Madrinich.
Oh, this is the big woods walk.
The big woods walk.
Oh, and a good time. What's the date again on that?
It'll be October 14th.
October 14th, is that a Saturday?
That is a Sunday.
A Sunday, okay. Sunday, October 14th. What time is it going to start?
It starts at 2 p.m. at the Visitor Center, and it's the admission to do the walk is $5 plus a standard Montpelier ticket, so you can come do a tour of the mansion and then
that'd be
go
a great
for a
time.
Hike in the woods.
Oh, and, that'd be a great time, but the colors are great.
The colors are great, October. And the summer heat has left, so.
Right. Well, that sounds like a fantastic thing to do, and yes, we've had Sandy on the show, and she's extraordinarily knowledgeable about all the trees. In fact, she describes herself as a tree woman. She takes care of all kinds of plants, but the trees are her thing.
Those are her children.
All right. Well, I can think of no one better to do it, so come along and go on the big walk in the woods. Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you.
James Madison surrounded himself with strong women who influenced his political and social views. The most notable was undeniably Dolly Madison. But there were other influential women in Madison's life, including abolitionist Frances Fanny Wright. Wright corresponded with Madison and even visited Montpelier following Madison's retirement from public office, where she challenged Madison's views on slavery. While the two failed to resolve their differences, Fanny wrote with the highest respect for Madison, while he reciprocated with great respect for her. Madison assured her that although his opinions of abolition may, quote, not coincide with yours, I hope you will not question either my admiration of the generous philanthropy which dictated it or my sense of the special regard it evinces for the honor and welfare of our expanding and, I trust, rising republic. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Professor Sanford Levinson of the University of Texas Law School. Sandy and I are talking about how our Constitution seems almost designed to produce the sort of gridlock that we're experiencing in Washington, D.C.
And we have to remember that's the way it was designed. It was, you know, when you talk about checks and balances, when you talk about separation of powers, it was designed to, effectively, you have to have at least two branches of the government working together to accomplish anything. And when you've got a division like this, you're never going to get that, or very rarely.
Again, I would emphasize that it was designed under the wholly fallacious assumption that you would have these virtuous, civic-minded individuals at the head of both the Congress and the President, and that the point of checks and balances was, you know, kind of two heads are better than one, or maybe even three heads are better than two, but they're all genuinely in it together, trying to do what is best for the United States. Instead, once you have a party system, then the incentives are quite different. Mitch McConnell has been extremely honest in telling the people that his principal goal as minority leader of the Republicans in the Senate is to do whatever he can to torpedo the possibility that Barack Obama will be reelected. And what this means is that he has every incentive in the world to try to deprive the president of anything that could be called an accomplishment. Because if the president is allowed to pass any programs that he thinks would help the country, and if, God forbid, they really did help the country, then this could only help his own reelection prospects. My view is that Senator McConnell recognizes that a principal force behind the election of George W. Bush in 2004 was Ted Kennedy, because Senator Kennedy cooperated very closely with President Bush on No Child Left Behind and then the prescription drug bill. So in 2004, Bush could run as somebody who had confronted two important domestic issues and who was able to work well with the leading Democrat in the Senate to bring about policy change. And McConnell is not stupid, And I think he said, why should I play Ted Kennedy's role? That the president will inevitably get the credit from the public if anything good happens on his watch. Similarly, most people blame the president, fairly or not, if things go wrong on his watch.
So you're saying our current structure and our Constitution encourages intransigence?
Yes, yes.
Now, what's the solution? A more parliamentary system? One party or the other is in charge, and they get to do what they're going to do for however long they can stay in office?
I have to say, I'm increasingly coming to that view, because it really does seem to me that if you read a book like the Mann Ornstein book or many of the others that are published or newspaper columns talking about the desirability of compromise, the need to generate a culture of compromise, et cetera, I think a lot of these books, even though I think their analysis is correct, end up being like whistling past the graveyard, because all they end up doing is giving a sermon on, we have these sinners in Congress, and they really ought to mend their ways by becoming more compromising. But you ask, well, what is it that has led them to be so intransigent? Is it character defects, or that they're just bad people? And I really don't think that that's a very plausible analysis. I think, as I suggested a few minutes ago, that Senator McConnell is behaving thoroughly rationally as someone devoted to the interests of the Republican Party.
Well, and I'm going to have to challenge you on that, and I'll play devil's advocate here for a minute, because we've had the same, more or less, the same constitutional system, certainly the same basic division of power for more than 200 years now, and yet this level of intransigence, this level of gridlock is, if not unprecedented, is certainly something that has not existed throughout our entire history. So isn't this just a passing political phase? Isn't this something that we will get out of eventually and we'll return to something where, you know, the government's work actually does get done as it has in the past?
Yeah, one might certainly hope so, but I'm not so confident. That I think one of the other things we generally do a bad job of teaching in our courses, again, at every level, is the fact that the 1787 Constitution survived for about 70 years until we had a war that killed 750,000 people, and then brought about some very basic constitutional change. But if you look up at the run-up to the war in the 1850s, you find the same kind of extraordinarily sharp divisions in Congress and the inability genuinely to achieve any solutions to what was then the central problem, which is obviously not merely slavery, but even more specifically, the extension of slavery into the territories. And now, I don't think we're at the verge of civil war, but I do think that we ought to realize that the polarization is not really unprecedented, and there is no foreseeable way out of this. Maybe it will happen. The great periods of significant change in the 20th century happened during really 4, at most 6 years of the Roosevelt administration, Franklin Roosevelt administration, when there were overwhelmingly Democratic majorities.
When they effectively had a parliamentary system because you had the Democrats in charge of the executive and the Congress.
In a sense, you could argue that. Mm-hmm. I mean, similarly, with regard to what were really the 2.5 key years of the Johnson administration, that is the immediate time after Kennedy's assassination, mm-hmm. and then his overwhelming victory with 61% of the vote, more, a higher percentage of the vote even than FDR had received in 1936, which swept in an overwhelming number of Democrats. But it's also really important to note that the Republican Party in the 1960s was a very, very different Republican Party from the one that it is now. And the basic reason has to do with one of the most important measures of the 1960s, which was the Voting Rights Act of 1965. When Lyndon Johnson signed the act, he told one of his aides that he was signing the death warrant for the Democratic Party that he had grown up in, and that really constituted the current Democratic Party as of that entire period. That Democratic Party was a so-called big tent of Northern liberals, labor unions, and a whole lot of white segregationists who were still in their own way fighting the Civil War, and where African Americans just basically didn't participate.
Right.
And that is now at an end, and it's been an end for a number of decades. And what you had was a profound transformation of the party system.
Yeah, in 1960, if you go back, say, roughly 50 years, in 1960, you had two major political parties, each of which had a conservative wing, each of which had a liberal wing. Now, you know, by and large, Republicans are probably more conservative on business issues. By and large, the Democrats are, you know, a little bit more liberal on those issues. On the social issues, it might have been a flip-flop. But the point is, right, you had two big tents, and so therefore there was a lot, maybe there was no, the consensus that existed at a national level was partly a function of the fact that neither party was all black or all white. Or, you know,
Richard Nixon probably would have won the presidency in 1960 had he had the wit to do what John F. Kennedy did, which was to call up, I think it was Daddy King, Martin Luther King's father, and express his concern about the arrest of Martin Luther King, because at that point, I think Martin Luther King Sr. was a Republican. I don't know if he had endorsed Nixon or not, but, you know, by no means was the Democratic Party the party of racial progressives.
Oh, no, not in the South especially.
That Adlai Stevenson in 1952 had picked Alabama Senator John Sparkman as his running mate, and Stevenson was decidedly cool on Brown versus Board of Education. Kennedy basically had no interest in domestic politics at the time he ran. He picked Lyndon Johnson not because he thought Johnson was the extraordinary progressive and liberal he turned out to be when he became president himself, but because he thought that Johnson would be a signal to the white South that he, Kennedy, was safe.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to talk about this. We don't have time to go into all the 1960s politics going on here, but if I could put it in larger terms, and I think relate it to your argument, what we had was a period before the Civil War where we were highly polarized, where things weren't getting done, and we had to solve that problem with a war. And then the war, of course, discombobulated everything. It created this new Republican Party, which was rejected in the South, even though in many respects Southerners after the Civil War were more consonant with Republican Party policies. So we had this great mix-up in our parties, and so we had these two conglomerate big tent parties right up until the 1960s when the Civil Rights Movement and the Voting Rights Act led to a repolarization. So it almost sounds like we're regressing to a mean. It sounds like that our default position is polarization. It just took us 150 years to get here.
Yeah, I think that that ought to be taken very seriously. You know, I think it ought to be emphasized that the result of the war was that at a political level, the white South actually got increased representation in the House of Representatives, because the original compromise with slavery, the so-called Three-Fifths Compromise, gave the slave South extra seats in the Senate. But for every 100 slaves, the slaves were counted as only 60 people. once slavery is eliminated, then each of the former slaves is now counted as a whole person. That's the good news. But the bad news is that they're basically not allowed to vote, whatever the 15th Amendment says, so that the South ends up getting extra representation in the House of Representatives and therefore the Electoral College after Appomattox.
Mm-hmm.
And that really isn't changed until the 1960s. And, you know, the 1960s, it would be hyperbolic in the extreme to say that we fought another version of the Civil War, but it's not all that hyperbolic to say that what the, especially the second half of the 1960s represented, was an attempt at a second Reconstruction that really was designed in many ways to change the existing regime of politics, particularly in the South. And it was, by and large, successful, at least at the electoral level, and that fundamentally transformed the party system. But the point is, it's the Constitution that provides the basic structure within which all of these things take place.
Yeah, and I have to laugh, Sandy, because I asked you what you thought was wrong with our Constitution now, and so you mentioned, big states, small states, that's one big, huge issue from the convention. And then the second thing you said was, and that separation of power things as well.
Yep.
you're not wasting any time on peripheral issues, are you? But actually, we have to draw this to a close now because we're running out of time. But you've pointed out some significant issues with our current Constitution. But I think your overarching issue is that we have to be willing to assess whether it's working well, and we have to be willing to change it when it's appropriate.
I mean, if I can just conclude with this, it's not really necessary that your listeners agree with Alexander Hamilton or apply Hamilton's view that the United States Constitution is imbecilic. All one really has to do is to say, it's a human product. It will inevitably have design flaws that will emerge as context change, and maybe we ought to spend some time thinking about it.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Professor Sanford Levinson of the University of Texas Law School. Thanks also to our scheduler who set it up, Carol Hutchinson, and to our distribution engineers who bring it to you all over the United States, Bob Hoffman and Larry Mayer. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.
Put on the chainsaw and listen to